This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
You don't know the price of electricity when you're consuming it. You just get a bill at the end of the month. So it'd be a little bit like going out to eat every night, and some nights you go to a really expensive dinner, and some nights you eat at Arby's. And, you know, you don't really know which one's the expensive one. And at the end of the month, you just get this bill in the mail. You know, that's how we pay our electric bills.
What does decarbonization mean? Well, it's not just what happens when your soda goes flat. Today on Sea Change Radio, we talk with Jesse Jenkins, researcher at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, about the decarbonization of the electric grid. We discuss the great progress being made in states like California, Texas, and New York, how fossil fuels and nuclear power might figure in the future, and the potential impact of something called distributed energy management systems. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Jesse Jenkins. He is a PhD candidate studying energy systems at MIT and at the Institute for Data Systems and Society at MIT. Jesse, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me back, Alex.
You have a piece in Applied Energy that you co-authored with Fernando de Cisterne and Auden Botterud. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right.
Hopefully that's close enough for them. Yeah, two colleagues of mine at Argonne National Lab, I guess until just recently. Fernando is now at the World Bank in Washington, D.C.
And the title is The Value of Energy Storage in Decarbonizing the Electricity Sector. So first, what is decarbonization for our listeners?
So decarbonization is the effort to reduce the carbon dioxide emissions and other greenhouse gases in the production of electricity in the power sector. We could speak more broadly about decarbonizing energy systems writ large. This paper is focused primarily on electricity and the role of energy storage in helping meet very low CO2 emissions goals in the electric power system, which is really pivotal to efforts to mitigate the worst impacts of climate change.
And with this paper, Applied Energy is an academic journal. Who is the audience you're writing for? What do you hope could be an end result for this research?
Well, there's really a few different audiences for this work. One is the engineering community that's working on energy storage devices and helping develop better, cheaper, higher performing energy storage devices, batteries and other forms of storing electricity, where we try to outline the value that those technologies play in a broader electric power system, how they interact with generation resources, power plants that run on natural gas or renewable energy sources, and the role that might play in meeting CO2 reduction goals, which can help inform the development of new technologies and the kinds of performance and cost targets they might need. But we're also trying to reach people who are thinking broadly about the energy system transitions that are underway in electric power systems, trying to grapple with the integration of new technologies, wind or solar power and variable renewable energy sources like that, and also meeting CO2 reduction goals. So it's kind of got a high-level audience where it's looking at the systems-level perspective and the efforts to change the way we make and use energy, and at the engineering community that's trying to develop better energy storage technologies.
And I want to hear your executive summary in a second, but one of the real challenges for you and your colleagues, I would imagine, is to try to project how far these technologies can go in terms of storage capacity, for example. When we spoke 6 years ago, for example, we were not as optimistic about the solar industry as it turned out. It's really prices have come down and penetration rates are greater than many predicted.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Anytime you're looking out into the future, particularly on the timescales that are involved in trying to address climate change and transition our energy system towards more low carbon sources, I mean, we're really talking about decades into the future, you know, sort of between now and 2050 is often a convenient mental target for discussion around electric power systems and climate change. And, you know, so we're talking 35 years into the future. Who knows what that future will look like? So what we're trying to do with this study is, rather than predict how energy storage technologies might develop, we're actually trying to understand what value different levels of energy storage would bring to the system. And that value gives us a cost target for future technology development. So rather than a prediction, we're trying to basically benchmark how cheap or how valuable storage needs to be before we are likely to see very high levels of storage adoption in power systems.
So in a nutshell, what are some of the conclusions you and your colleagues reached?
Well, the conclusions we reach are that new forms of energy storage, electric batteries, and other novel technologies that are coming onto the market now could have significant value in electric power systems and really replace some of the power plants that we rely on today, particularly those power plants that we only use and turn on to meet very high levels of energy demand that occur occasionally throughout the year. Think about like a hot June day or July day when it's muggy and everybody's got their air conditioning on. Electricity demand can really spike in those hours. And so we have a whole fleet of what we call peaking power plants that are really just standing by for those few days in the year when they're needed to meet those peaks in demand when electricity's use is really high. And so in particular, if we could store energy, say from overnight when people are sleeping and the lights are off and the air conditioning is turned down, and use that power later in the day, we could eliminate some of those infrequently used peaking power plants and reduce the cost of meeting our electricity needs. And then the other important role for energy storage is in helping us take better advantage of variable renewable energy sources like wind and solar power. The output of wind and solar energy facilities obviously changes with the availability of solar and wind resources. So as the wind blows at different speeds or as the sun comes out or as clouds pass over, the output of those renewable energy sources changes. And that's something that we need to match and deal with that fluctuation either by ramping up and down other more flexible power plants or by storing energy to fill in those gaps when wind and solar production falls. And so if we have cheap energy storage, that might give us more tools to help integrate variable renewable energy sources and take better advantage of increasingly affordable wind and solar power.
And you think that wind is going to make greater strides as longer duration storage increases? That wind will increase at a faster rate than solar. Is that fair to say?
Well, we see that both are likely to increase given the technology cost assumptions we used here. And again, you know, there's, as we mentioned, there's a lot of uncertainty in the costs for these inputs. We do see a bigger share for wind in the power system that we're looking at, which is Texas, which has some great wind resources, especially in West Texas. Actually, Texas leads the country, I think, in total installed capacity for wind still. And so this is a place where you're going to see a lot of potentially affordable wind energy and also solar energy that can grow and help meet daytime energy demand. What was interesting in our findings is that when we looked at two different durations of storage capacity, so a battery that could store energy for 2 hours at its full capacity and one that could store for 10 hours, we found that the longer duration energy storage device was actually better matched to the variations in wind power, and the shorter duration energy storage device was better matched to the variations in solar power output.
Why is that? Is that because the sun comes up every day, but the wind doesn't blow every day? Is that fair to guess?
Well, that's close. Solar is quite predictable. Of course, it's only going to be producing power when the sun's out in the middle of the day. And so what that means is that the solar output is actually very spiky. You know, there's a few hours in the middle of the day when the solar panels are producing the most output. And with just 2 hours of energy storage capacity, you could shift that, you know, noon or 1 p.m. energy production, some of the peak solar output, a couple hours later into the afternoon and meet energy demands in the afternoon, which are also quite high around, you know, 4 or 5 p.m. With wind, it's a little bit different in that wind energy output tends to be highest at night. And that's exactly when energy demand is the lowest. So to take full advantage of that wind power, we need a longer duration energy storage battery that can spend more time charging up over the night and then shift that energy into the daytime hours.
And is it fair to make that conclusion based on Texas, which is, as you said, leading the country in terms of wind capacity? Is that going to be an aberration, or is that a fair baseline to use?
Well, in this case, we actually model a greenfield mix, which means that we build the power, we let the model we've developed build the power system from scratch. So we're not taking into account the current installed capacity in Texas. We're just trying to use Texas solar and wind resource data and energy demand data so that we can make sure that those are all consistent with one another, you know, so that we're using solar output that corresponds to a hot, sunny day when electricity demand also reflects the same output.
Will you wear green, oh my dear, oh my dear? Will you wear green, Jenny Jenkins?
No, I won't wear green, it's a shame to be seen.
I'll buy me a folder, roller, tilde, tolly, seek a double user, cause you roll to find me. Roll, Jenny Jenkins, roll. Will you wear blue, oh my dear, oh my dear? Will you wear blue, Jenny Jenkins?
No, I won't wear blue, for the color's too true.
I'll buy me a foldy, roly, tilty, tolly, seeky, double, use it, cause you roll to find me. Roll, Jenny Jenkins, roll.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to MIT PhD candidate Jesse Jenkins. So, Jesse, New York, California, Texas, these are the three most populous states in the country, all have very interesting and, some may say, aggressive carbon reduction plans. New York has decided to continue to operate its nuclear plants while California will be shutting them down. It has been announced that Diablo Canyon will be shutting down in 2025. At least that's the plan. But you're looking at the Texas plan, which has a aggressive plan for carbon reduction, but to 2035. Why don't you tell us why you chose Texas and maybe compare those three states for us? I know they're very complicated, but in a nutshell, if you will.
Yeah, so in terms of the emissions reduction goals we looked at, we were actually using the National Clean Power Plan objectives for 2035 or 2030 as one of our benchmarks. We were actually going beyond what's currently on the books, even in most places and in Texas as well, and looking at much more significant reductions in carbon that would have to happen by 2050. So looking at 80 or 90% reductions in CO2 in the electric power sector, which is really what we should be targeting. California's headed that direction. AB 32, which passed in 2006, targeted an 80% reduction below 1990 levels for the state by 2050. And the newly enacted SB 32, which was enacted this year, sets an interim 2030 goal for the state of California, which is to get to 40% below 1990 levels by 2030, which is a pretty significant leap from current emissions levels. So we just chose Texas in this case because we had the data available and because Texas is, interestingly enough, an isolated power grid. For odd historical reasons, we have three different interconnected power grids in the country. One that spans the western half of the United States and parts of Canada, the other that spans most of the eastern United States and parts of Canada, and then Texas, which, as Texas often does, goes it alone and has its own separately managed power grid called the ERCOT system. So we modeled that because it's effectively a power grid island, and that helps us simplify the modeling. And so sort of a target of convenience in this case.
And California is the sixth largest economy in the world. Why don't you outline what their targets are and how realistic they are?
Yeah, so initially, California, with AB 32, set out to get back to 1990 emissions levels by 2020. And the state is largely on track to do that, thanks to a whole suite of different policies that have been implemented, including subsidies for electric vehicles, a low carbon fuel standard that helps support biofuels and other lower carbon fuel sources, aggressive pursuit of better energy efficiency, fuel economy standards, which have now helped establish federal standards that are more aggressive, and efforts to reduce emissions in the power sector by growing the share of renewable energy sources and implementing an emissions cap and trade program. So there's a bunch of different measures that have been pursued in California, and they've got the state on track to get back to 1990 levels by the end of this decade. The now the challenge is to up the pace of progress and to get in line with the longer term 2050 goals of really almost taking carbon emissions down to zero. And in order to do that, the state has set the goal with SB 32 this year of a 40% emissions reduction below 1990 in 2030. So basically that means that we get back to 1990 levels in 2020, and then we go 40% further over the next decade, which is an extremely rapid reduction in emissions, and is going to take a kind of kitchen sink approach for California to get there, according to most of the analysis out there. So really everything that the state can do to reduce emissions, it should be doing. It's going to be an interesting test to see whether states can drive down emissions that quickly. I hope California is successful, because that's the kind of pace of emissions reductions we really need from a bunch of other localities as well to try to tackle climate change.
And it seems like there's a lot of debate as to whether or not shutting down Diablo Canyon will still enable California to reach its goals. I mean, it's a 9% or so of its electricity production.
Yeah.
First of all, how long in advance does PG&E, the utility that operates Diablo Canyon, how long in advance do they need before that decision is made that it's shutting down in 2025? I mean, this is not something they're going to decide in 2024, I'm assuming.
No, obviously it's better if we plan ahead, especially when it comes to trying to replace a large power source like a nuclear power station. As you said, Diablo Canyon produces a really staggering amount of electricity. It provides about 9% of California's electricity. Which is quite significant, all of it without any CO2 emissions, of course. And you know, for contrast, to see what happens when a plant like that shuts down rapidly, we can look to the south, to the San Onofre nuclear power station that was operating near San Diego. And due to a botched repair job, a replacement of the steam turbines on the generation side of the power station was done poorly by the contractors, the plant had to close because it would have been too expensive to try to replace those generators a second time. And in the short term, that really threw the California power system into almost crisis mode, trying to get ready just a few months later to meet summertime peak electricity demands in Southern California. And the state had to rely much more heavily on natural gas-fired power plants to replace the San Onofre plant.
What year was this?
San Onofre closed in 2013, I believe.
But this was different than the brownout period that California has suffered from.
Yeah.
That was a few years
that
before,
That was a few years
right?
before, yeah. So I think that the system operators avoided any brownouts, but they had to rely on much greater dependence on natural gas plants, on diesel generators, and on demand response, people cutting back on energy consumption and getting paid to do so in order to get through the summer peaks. And so we really want to plan ahead if we're going to try to replace one of these plants. And that's what PG&E is trying to do here. They've reached an agreement with some environmental groups, including Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC, and Greenpeace, and the Electrical Union to shut down the plant, one of the reactors in 2024 and the other in 2025. So we really have sort of another 8-9 years before this plan goes into effect, and it still needs to be approved. This is a negotiated deal between some of the stakeholders, but it still needs to be approved by state regulators. So it's not a done deal, but that's certainly the direction that the PG&E and environmental groups like NRDC and Greenpeace are trying to take the state at the moment.
So what would you advise if you were talking to Jerry Brown tomorrow?
I would say that we need to be building our renewable energy growth on top of the existing low carbon sources that we have, including the state's hydropower and nuclear resources. And until the state has reached its long-term emissions goals, really until it's shut down the last fossil plants, it doesn't make a lot of sense to shut down existing low carbon power sources like nuclear and hydro.
Love, love, why is there light? Did you forget?
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Jesse Jenkins. He's a PhD candidate at studying energy systems at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. So Jesse, you're just talking about trying to attain least cost generation mix. And as you note in your paper in Applied Energy, there's no silver bullet. But one of the things that isn't discussed in your paper that I'd like you to expand on is the idea of getting away from traditional grids, especially as we get to these renewable systems like solar and wind, where it doesn't necessarily have to be on the utility scale. What do you think about the chances of meeting goals like California, New York, and Texas have set out in a more of a hybrid system where it's not all grid-based?
Yeah, that's a great question. And while we don't address that in the Applied Energy study, that is exactly what we're looking at as part of MIT's Utility of the Future study, which will be published later this year. And is a two-year effort that I've been one of the researchers on to really explore these increasing opportunities for distributed or decentralized energy production and other distributed sources of electricity services. And we do, you know, see the possibility for a much more distributed future than we have today. But there are some real limitations to distributed resources that are also important.
For example?
Yeah. So, for example, you mentioned, you know, solar energy, for example, could be deployed at a bunch of different scales. You could build very large solar farms out in the desert. You know, California has several hundred megawatt size solar farms that can provide power for hundreds of thousands of people. And then you also have, many people producing power on their own rooftops with very small scale solar systems. So when it comes to solar energy and indeed energy storage devices and microgenerators and other devices like that can be deployed at multiple scales, we have to think about two different numbers. The first is, what is the additional locational value that we call it, that you get from being distributed? So how much additional value do you have from being smaller and more closely located with demand? And that value can come from reducing losses from electrical transmission. It can come from avoiding constraints in electricity networks or deferring investments to upgrade those grids. And it can come potentially from added reliability in the case of energy storage devices or backup generators. And these are sort of additional services that can't be provided by conventional centralized generators and give additional value or locational value to distributed resources. And so that's their advantage. But on the other hand, there are still real economies of scale in the installation of many of these devices. So it might cost 2 to 3 times as much, for example, to install a solar system, a few kilowatts of solar PV panels on someone's rooftop, as it would to deploy several hundred megawatts of large utility scale solar. So we have to consider both the added value, but also the added cost of being distributed and smaller scale. And in many cases, the numbers unfortunately don't add up very favorably for the small scale distributed resources.
And you do note also in your paper the concomitant economies of scale in terms of energy storage that will come as renewables continue to ramp up, right?
Yeah, so energy storage devices also have pretty clear economies of scale. You know, Tesla is selling its Powerwall device, for example, which is a storage battery that's fairly small and could be installed in someone's garage or basement and provide backup power or the ability to store energy from a solar panel on your roof or from the grid when power is cheap and use it later. And those smaller scale storage devices are still quite a bit more expensive than larger multi-megawatt scale storage devices using the same technology, lithium-ion batteries, at a much larger scale. It's interesting, when we look at storage economics, it looks like the economies of scale might tap out at more like the megawatt or a few megawatt scale, which would still be much more distributed than conventional power plants, which usually measure in the hundreds of megawatts and are much larger. So we could potentially, you know, deploy energy storage devices in a much more decentralized fashion at large buildings or power substations within the distribution grid. But it's much more expensive to install many small 5 kilowatt batteries in people's homes or small businesses than it would be to group them into larger systems. So these trade-offs are real for both solar and energy storage devices, and are an important part of the calculation for the economics of distributed resources.
And we're just talking about storage, but there's something else that you discuss in your paper, flexible demand. What is that, and how should that be viewed as we look towards these decarbonization solutions down the road on a big policy level?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in electric power systems historically are kind of a weird marketplace where you don't know the price of electricity when you're consuming it. You just get a bill at the end of the month. So it'd be a little bit like going out to eat every night, and some nights you go to a really expensive dinner and some nights you eat at Arby's. And you don't really know which one's the expensive one. And at the end of the day, or at the end of the month, you just get this bill in the mail. You know, that's how we pay our electric bills. And so in that context, it's really a one-sided market where we just go on consuming electricity, and then we have to run the generators and energy storage, if it exists, and other resources to meet demand at all times. Well, there's a huge opportunity, an untapped opportunity, to make use of much more flexible and price-responsive demand that taps the cheaper and ever-present information and communications capabilities in our modern era. You know, the ability to send people information about when the prices are spiking or when the power system is under stress, and allow people to voluntarily cut back on their energy consumption during those hours in order to save what could be quite a lot of money. And so what our study has found is that the opportunity to send more granular prices and incentives to electricity consumers could unlock an enormous amount of demand flexibility that could avoid having to make costly investments in expanding the power grid or our generating capabilities for, you know, times that really only come rarely, when electricity demand peaks and we have to use our full capacity on the grid. So one example of that is the Nest thermostat that probably a lot of folks have heard of recently.
Sure.
There's many other opportunities or many alternative competitors that offer flexible thermostats. But these are devices that have the smarts in them that to be able to receive your inputs about your comfort preferences. So, you know, how many degrees, do you want the temperature to be, and are you okay with it fluctuating a couple of degrees up and down from that ideal set point? So maybe you say you want it to be 70 degrees, but you're okay if it goes between 68 and 72. And then those smart thermostats can also receive remote signals from electricity markets or from system operators or utilities that tell it, hey, this is an hour when electricity is really expensive, or actually even more importantly, in 2 hours from now, we think electricity is going to be really expensive because demand is going to pick up. Why don't you pre-cool right now and bring that temperature down to 68 degrees and then let it gradually climb back up to 72 over the next couple hours? You know, as an occupant, you don't really notice that. It's not a huge difference on your comfort level, but it could save a lot of money for yourself and for the grid by better optimizing when we consume electricity. And so that's just one example of the kind of flexible demand that we could see on much greater scale if we create the right incentives to bring the demand side into the marketplace.
Jesse Jenkins, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. It's a pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Taj Mahal, Jerry Garcia and David Grisman, and Lou Reed. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.